Once again, welcome to the Call to the Cannon podcast. I'm your host, Zach. My special guest tonight will be...
My name is Nick.
Nick, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I feel special.
You should. And the topic for discussion for today's podcast will be the 2008 direct-to-video DC animated feature, Justice League, The New Frontier. Like I said, this is a direct-to-video animated feature from the DC universe, based off of a graphic novel. The graphic novel was written by Darwin Cook, and I believe that it was released in 2004.
Yes, that is correct. It was released in mid to late 2004. Darwin Cook, of course, wrote and drew the comic series.
Now, this is an interesting film because it's based off a very interesting graphic novel that stands alone. It's an out-of-continuity series, and it takes place in an alternate DC universe in a way, and correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, it doesn't follow traditional DC continuity.
Not what you would see in your, the mainstream DC comics. I mean, obviously they follow the same sort of backstories that a lot of the characters have. It stands on its own. It doesn't connect to anything that you'd see in your average Batman or Wonder Woman comic you'd go to the comic store today.
Now, this is interesting because this is Darwin Cook's love letter to the characters and stories of the Silver Age of DC Comics. If you're unfamiliar with the Silver Age, it's the era of comics that ran from about the early to mid-1950s until about the late 1960s. This is an out-of-continuity story, and it stars the DC heroes from DC's Silver Age. And what we mean by that is it stars Hal Jordan as the Green Lantern, and it also stars Barry Allen as the Flash, and then you've got your typical Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman trifecta going on. And then we get a lot of little side characters from the DC universe, characters like Colonel Rick Flagg, and characters like the Martian Manhunter and things like that. This takes place in an alternate United States of the 1950s and early 1960s. And what is happening here is that during this alternate but somewhat realistic United States, the world is under the threat from this new psychic villain that calls itself the Center. And the Center is leading our heroes towards an epic confrontation, and they're trying to unite together to form the New Frontier, which is a quote from President John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, that seems to sum it up pretty succinctly.
So what's going on is we've got various events that took place in the 1950s, got the Indochina War going on, where we see Superman and Wonder Woman helping the United States government with the communist rebels there. We've got the Flash and his girlfriend Iris, and she's kind of hanging out in Las Vegas and part of it, and talking to someone who looks suspiciously like Frank Sinatra. We've got a whole bunch of little pop culture things going on that people who would have grown up in this time period, people like my dad and your dad, Nick, because I think that they're of similar ages, they would have seen this stuff, a lot of this stuff on TV, like these little pop culture touches.
Oh yeah, definitely. Especially just to talk about the comic series, see the artwork, it's very much reminiscent of the artwork that was common in the comic books back in those days. A lot of the crisp, sharp lines of the characters and the vibrant colors and all that.
And I gotta say that I really enjoy that. I like that a lot. I think that it's a very cool way to do this. It makes it very, very retro. It's a blast from the past, and it's very, very endearing. Let's go ahead and talk about some of the characters in the film. We said that Hal Jordan's Green Lantern is one of the main characters of the film. He's got an interesting story because he doesn't actually become the Green Lantern until about three-fourths of the way through the movie. This story really puts Hal Jordan, he's kind of the first person to be seen in the movie when he's flying as a pilot in the Korean War, and his story kind of ties everything together, and it's only until he can face his fear and overcome his fears and his doubts that he can truly tap into power of the Green Lantern. And I really like how it all comes together for him. Do you want to talk a little bit more about him, or would you like to move on and talk about somebody else?
Well, I would agree that Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, definitely is the centerpiece. I think the movie, by and large, is a ensemble piece, but Hal Jordan mixed in with Martian Manhunter, I would say, are the two main focus characters that this movie centers on.
So let's talk a little bit about John Jones, the Martian Manhunter. John Jones is a really cool superhero, And it's kind of sad that he is not one of the more popular members of the Justice League. Although I think that it could be argued that within the fan community, he does have a pretty strong following. But by and large, he's never really been a popular character as far as the public is concerned. John Jones is the Martian Manhunter, and he's accidentally transported to Earth, Gotham City to be precise. And when he's brought here, he realizes that he has no way of getting back. So his story is pretty interesting because while searching for an identity, he becomes a detective on the streets of Gotham City, and it is through this that he is able to meet up with Batman, and they partner up. The Center and its psychic powers are starting to cause various cults to come about in the major cities of the world, and Gotham City is one of the larger cities in America. Obviously, Gotham City is fictional, but it's one of the larger cities in the DC universe. Batman and the Martian Manhunter team up to get to the bottom of these mysterious cults, and what they find out along the way is that the Center is behind them. And John Jones, the Martian Manhunter, he fears the Center greatly, and he also fears humanity greatly, because what's going on during this time period is what's known as the Red Scare. Communism is the major source of fear for Americans. And since John Jones is not an American, he's an outsider, he is kind of used as a Cold War allegory character. He's doing his best to blend in with American culture, but he wants to get back to Mars. And it is his desire to get back to Mars that kind of also puts him together with the character of King Faraday, with the character of King Faraday. And it is through that that they form a friendship, and they are eventually united to fight against the Center.
Yeah, I have to agree. John Jones really was a great character. I liked how they used him. Don't really know a whole lot about Martian Manhunter to begin with, so seeing him as a featured character in this film definitely was a new experience for me. And seeing him, his character being used was kind of, a smart move on Darwin Cook's part when putting this story together.
I think that Darwin Cook does a good job of taking characters who are B or C or even D or E level heroes and putting them to the forefront of his work. And I think that this is a very, very good example of this is within The New Frontier. And then I would say perhaps the third most important character to the story is Barry Allen's Flash. Barry Allen is going through a bit of a crisis in this story. He knows he's not as powerful as Superman. He knows he doesn't have the resources of Batman. He knows he's not as big and strong as Wonder Woman. So he's always wondering, he's always doubting himself. He's like, I've got this super speed, but all I'm able to do is to fight purse snatchers and get, you know, kittens out of trees and things of that nature. So he's kind of having this crisis of faith where he's coming to terms with himself as the Flash. At one point in the film, he decides to hang up his red costume because he fears for the safety of his fiancée, Iris, and he doesn't want to put her in danger either. So these two things combined, he decides that he's going to retire. However, he becomes very important when his super speed needs to be put to use in the fight against the Center.
Yeah, one of the things I think was interesting is the fact that, you know, Barry Allen, Flash, he definitely is a B-level character that realizes he's a B-level character, and that's his big arc in the film. Even though he really doesn't appear all that much, he definitely has a strong arc that he goes through as he steps up to that A-level plate.
Talked about this a little bit in the past, Nick, and I know that you find this interesting, the fact that the three DC flagship characters, and by that I mean the characters of Wonder Woman, Superman, and the Batman, take a back seat in this movie, and how we both thought that was a good thing.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about this movie was the fact that the three main characters, Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, were second-tier players in this movie, and gave the chance for the second-level superhero characters to step up and really, you know, take the spotlight. I thought that was really, you know, an excellent way of doing it, just because it hadn't really been done a whole lot in movies or cartoons or anything like that.
I think that we should talk about some of the side characters and some of the D and E level characters that Darwin Cook puts into this movie. One of those is Ace Morgan, and I like Ace's character a lot in this. He serves as kind of a big brother character to Hal. He was friends with Hal Jordan's dad when Hal was just a wee lad. But he's kind of a badass in his own right. He's an excellent pilot. He pilots a plane into the center of the center at the end of the film. And even though he has no superpowers, you can tell that he's a very brave character and a very useful member of the assault on the center. And I really liked him a lot. He's like this all-American, you know, football playing, hot dog eating type of a guy that, you know, you could have a beer with or something like that. And I think that it comes through a lot, especially in the character's voice actor, who is John Hurd.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed in a lot of animated movies is that the voice acting, while it's pretty good, I mean, I'm easy to please when it comes to that sort of stuff, it's very generic, like the person's doing their own voice. Unless if it's a show like The Simpsons or a Disney animated feature, a lot of the voice acting, especially for direct-to-DVD sort of movies, is very much, oh, this is my voice, I'm saying the lines.
Some of the other voice actors that come through strongly, I think David Boreanaz does a great job as Hal Jordan. I also like Neil Patrick Harris as the Flash as well. And while he doesn't get a whole lot of lines, the lines that he does get, he's got like the little comic relief lines, and they're funny enough, and they're well acted enough. I also like Miguel Ferrer as the Martian Manhunter. I think that he does a good job there as well. So there are some solid voice actors within this movie.
That's the one thing I really have to give the DC animated movies as of late credit for, that they have been doing an awesome job in pretty much every single one of their releases when it comes to voice acting, especially this one. Like, the voices you already mentioned, I think, were great. I have to really give kudos. Lucy Lawless as Wonder Woman, if they ever get around to making a Wonder Woman movie and they're magically able to cast anyone from any era, Lucy Lawless from like 10 years ago would have been perfect. When I saw that she was cast as Wonder Woman in this, I was thinking, oh, that is perfect casting there.
And another reason to root for Darwin Cook's New Frontier creation. I really have to give him credit for getting things accurate to the time era, because again, even though this is obviously not Earth as we know it, he's taking a lot of things that happened in history and putting them into this fictional story. And that takes a lot of research, and there's a lot of attention to detail in that.
Oh, definitely.
So, Nick, who had the coolest backstory among the characters?
Coolest backstory? Oh, I think that much is obvious. Cub reporter Jimmy Olsen.
Korean War reporter Jimmy Olsen?
No, I got... Now, to be serious, I have to say Martian Manhunter. As I mentioned, I didn't know a whole lot about him compared to the other characters in the film, so it was very interesting to see his origin and his storyline develop. I thought it was very well done. I really, really enjoyed, you know, seeing that play out.
I gotta agree with you there. I was really happy that they included the Manhunter in this movie. And I have to say that the first time I watched it, every time he came on, I was so intrigued by him. I wanted to know what he was going to do next, because he's a shapeshifter, and he has this hideous alien form, but then he shapeshifts into humans so that they'll accept him. But then he's watching TV, and he shapeshifts into Bugs Bunny, and then he changed into Groucho Marx. And it's really funny, because he's really getting into this American culture, and he's drinking soda pop and doing things like that. And I really liked him as a detective. And the graphic novel goes into more detail about his detective work, and I kind of missed that from the film. So maybe we should talk about some of the shortfalls of the film, where it doesn't work for us. And that would be one particular area where it doesn't work for me. That's one example of that. A lot of good stuff was cut to fit the time constraints of this film.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things, like, the movie begins 50 pages into the actual comic. For those of you who are unfamiliar with comics, 50 pages is a huge chunk of a comic. And what they cut out in short, for those of you who have already seen the movie, hopefully everyone has, because we've been spoiling it left and right.
There are no spoilers on the Call to the Canon podcast.
Oh, Rosebud was the sled.
Liam Neeson is Ra's al Ghul.
For those of you who haven't read the original comic, the movie begins about 50 pages into it. And the stuff they cut out, at least for me, you might disagree, Zach, is more motivation about what the center was about and giving more of a rationale for why all of a sudden at the end of the movie they're fighting all these dinosaurs and prehistoric creatures. Because for me, Zach, I think that the movie was going this one direction, this sort of B-level sci-fi movie where Martians are on Earth, Hal Jordan's into a shady government program that's going to go to Mars and defeat the Martians, and Martian Manhunter wants to get home. So I had this sort of B-movie, Day the Earth Stood Still, 1950s sci-fi sort of feel to it. And then all of a sudden, we jump to Dinosaur Land, and it's kind of this big, for lack of a better term, tone shift that didn't set right with me, I don't think.
There is a tonal shift, and I think if they had started the film off with not necessarily explaining, but giving us some inside looks, perhaps, into what the center is. So the center is also known as Dinosaur Island. That tonal shift may not have been there. At the very least, it would have been lessened, I think. But I would agree with you that we are definitely missing out on some integral backstory as far as the center goes. I still like the center as a villain a lot. I'm glad that they used this. People don't really know, but the center has actually been around. Dinosaur Island has been around since like 1935 as a villain in the DC universe. So I think that Darwin Cook's use of it in this movie definitely fits in with all these things that he's pulling from DC's past. But yeah, I would definitely agree with you that they cut out a lot of stuff that would have been cool to see and would have given us a lot more of a backstory.
Which it wasn't, for lack of a better term, cartoony evil, but it had very much threatening evil that you could buy it as a threat to humanity.
It's very, very biblical in a way.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, the center is a very biblical supervillain. I like the center personally. We should talk about some of the cameos that pop up in this film. Fan favorite villain Captain Cold drops in for a visit and is quickly dispatched by the Flash. But Gorilla Grodd shows up, or at least a robotic version of Gorilla Grodd.
Yeah, the Flash's villains, more commonly known as the worst villains of mankind.
Flash has the worst rogues gallery. So what are some other cameos in this film that show up that either surprised you or that you liked?
Well, let's see. Steel made a quick appearance in the background.
Yeah, John Henry.
John Henry Irons.
Also, Adam Strange pops up. Adam Strange is kind of a cool character. I like him. He's the one with the backpack and the jetpack backpack and the laser gun. And he's flying around when everybody's is piloting jets and shooting dinosaurs and pterodactyls and things. He's just out flying around shooting them.
Yeah. The Atom shows up.
Yes, the Atom shows up.
And of course, the aforementioned Challengers of the Unknown have cameo appearances in here, but they play a much larger role in the original graphic novel. I think they cut out a lot of good character moments that would have been fun to see on screen, like when Flash is fighting Captain Cold in that club. Like, Bruce Wayne is there, Lois Lane is there, and a bunch of these other super... I think Oliver Queen is there as well.
Yes, yeah.
Bunch of these other superheroes are there in their secret identities, and they're like making comments back and forth, and they're seeing Flash fight Captain Cold, saying, "Hey, should we intervene?" Like, no, this is the Flash. This should be fun to watch. And they're like, almost like it's a spectator sport for them, which I thought was kind of a neat thing to see play out. But of course, they cut that for time in the movie. But yeah.
Wildcat also shows up in the graphic novel, which is interesting because he's the boxer, and I can't think of his name. I think it's
he gets like the last bout of strength to punch out his opponent.
Yeah, and his opponent is none other than Muhammad Ali.
I didn't catch that that reference.
They
there.
Make reference to him being called Cassius Clay or something, which is Muhammad Ali's which is his name before he goes all Malcolm X. But but yeah, there are a lot of really
Now.
There are a lot of really cool character moments. I think that this film is very strong, and I think that it should be seen by more people. Even though it's an animated film, and even though it's based off a comic book, it has a lot of mature and adult themes going on in it. There is quite a fair amount of violence in it. I don't think that any fan of an action film would be disappointed by the level of violence in this movie, and the level of cool action set pieces, and cool scenes, and pithy dialogue, and neat animated special effects and things of that nature. Basically, if you are a fan of some of the recent comic book movies like last year's Iron Man and The Dark Knight, or even this year's Wolverine movie, even though I don't think that was a very good film, but if you like movies like those, you know, comic book movies, Spider-Man movies and things of that nature, it stands to reason that you're going to like this as well. If you're a very casual reader of the DC comics, I think there is stuff in here for you as well, in addition. So I definitely think it's worth checking out. One of the things that we do here at the Cult It or Can It podcast as we ultimately decide whether we should cult or can a film. And what we mean by cult a film is, does this film have some kind of value? Is it interesting? Is it worth your time to check out? And what we mean by can is, should we get rid of this film? Should we maybe recommend it if you can get it in the red box for a dollar, but other than that, stay, you know, 30 miles from it at all time? Does it have no redeeming values for society? And I have to say that I think this film does have a lot of value. I'm going to cult this film. My final thought on this film, before we get to Nick, is that I think that there are a whole lot of interesting, rich, layered subtext from real-world 1950s and early 1960s America. And I like the way that Darwin Cook took a lot of that stuff from this whole Red Scare, we're fighting the communists, golden age of America, Leave It to Beaver is on TV, mom is doing the dishes in high heels and pearl necklace. We've got this fantasy view of the 1950s that obviously never really happened. I like the way that Darwin Cook is taking that and channeling that into this comic book and into this movie. So I'm going to have to say cult this movie.
A lot of things that you said I agree with, Zach. I think that there's a lot here to like. Few of the things that you mentioned, how they talk about a lot of the political stuff and the Red Scare. I really wish that the movie actually did more with that. It just seemed it was mentioned and then kind of forgotten about, but that's a small criticism of the movie. I would say, and this is a little bit different, I would say that if you're a fan of DC Comics and you like comics in general, check it out, cult it. I think you'd enjoy it. I think you would appreciate it. If you're not that big of a fan of comics, like the only thing that you do with comics is maybe go see that year's big movie, like be it an Iron Man or a Dark Knight or a Wolverine. If that's the only thing you really have access with comics and you really don't follow them in book form, can it. Because I don't think you would really appreciate it just because there are a lot of inside things when it comes to the DC comic universe.
All right, so having said that, thank you for listening to the Cult It or Can It podcast. As always, you can visit our blog at http://cultitorcanit.blogspot.com. Feel free to leave us some responses. Feel free to suggest some movies for us. So thank you for joining, thank you for listening, and we hope that you'll be a part of us in the future. So for my co-host today, Nick, I am saying, once again, thank you for listening to the Cult It or Can It podcast.